Good afternoon, everybody. So let's stay in the Southwest where it's nice and warm, shall we? So I am a researcher with the ARS based in Maricopa, Arizona, about 30 miles southwest of Phoenix, Arizona. And I work exclusively with the reclaimed water used for irrigation of municipal turf areas. So a little bit about what I'm going to talk about today. We'll get away from the chemicals just a little bit. I'm going to talk about E. coli and reclaimed water and why we should be worried about the importance of this parameter. Talk a little bit about a constructed wetland study that in which I discovered the existence of false positives in E. coli analyses, and talk about the follow-up work to that is determining the rates of false positives and some of the causes, and then a final question: are molecular assays the answer? So water quality standards nationwide are pretty much dictated by the EPA, which still relies on the total coliform rule for surface and drinking waters throughout the U.S. And for about 2 years, we've heard whisperings that the Science Advisory Board is considering updating the total coliform rule to rely on only E. coli as the single fecal indicator, and moving away from the total coliforms and fecal coliforms that the TCR, total coliform rule, is based on. And reclaimed water at this point is regulated state to state, but many states follow the EPA regulations for coliform. And so how would a change in EPA standards affect reclaimed water? We really don't know, but it's very possible that E. coli may increase in importance. So about 3 or 4 years ago, I started monitoring E. coli levels in a constructed wetland in Phoenix that is filled completely with tertiary treated reclaimed municipal wastewater. I should point out that the water entering the wetland from the treatment plant had no viable E. coli. So the E. coli that we're monitoring did not necessarily come from the reclaimed water. I must point that out, because the treatment plant, in fact, does a very good job. But in fact, University of Arizona study the year before we started our studies found seasonal E. coli blooms in the wetland as high as 20,000 colony forming units per 100 mils of water. Not really surprising, since this wetland is really a haven for all kinds of wildlife. It's the only open body of water for miles around, essentially, and so migratory waterfowl, coyotes, beavers, you name it, they've all found this wetland. This wetland water does go into the Salt River. Arizona rivers are kind of funny. They don't have any water in them most of the year. So, you know, people are often confounded by that. However, it's very possible that during a storm event, the water entering the Salt River could potentially be used for urban irrigation. And the guidelines for urban irrigation dictated by the Department of Environmental Quality in Arizona say that we should not have higher than 800 CFU total coliforms per 100 mil. So these levels of E. coli potentially leaving the wetland were of some concern. So for about 7 months in late 2005, early 2006, we monitored E. coli levels in water leaving the wetland. And we found a very interesting but distinct seasonal pattern, that the E. coli levels tended to be very, very low in the summer when it was hot. But when it cooled off and the migratory waterfowl came through in the fall, the E. coli levels exploded quite a bit. But one thing that we did during this study, any of you who are familiar with E. coli analyses will recognize this as a membrane filtration assay. We used MI auger. And basically the way the assay works is the E. coli on the plate turn blue. So what we did during this study is when we found E. coli, we would collect a subset of them off of the plate and save them for PCR confirmation just to ensure that what we were calling E. coli actually was. And we used an assay that code the gene target codes for an outer membrane protein that is common to all known E. coli. And what we found is that when we actually corrected the data for the presumptive data that we had come up to begin with and then corrected it in the lighter gray bars, you will see that the results were quite a bit different. And in fact, if you look at the regulatory guideline of 800 CFU per 100 mils, it's very possible that the water leaving this wetland, if you had analyzed it by the EPA-approved methods, you may have thought that it was above regulatory guidelines, but actually it may not have been at all. So why is this important? Well, it was showing that there was something about the water in this wetland. It could have been the fact that it was reclaimed water. It hindered the accuracy of these widely used coliform assays. And the fact that we were finding false positives could mean that water managers, reclaimed water managers, could be relying on data indicating that water leaving their treatment plant is out of compliance when actually it's not. So about a year ago, I began a study with the researcher, Dr. Chana Rock at the University of Arizona, to look at these false positive rates for reclaimed water that's being used for irrigation. So what we did is we took monthly water samples from an irrigation water pond that was used for storage of water before irrigation. We took soil samples and collected samples from 8 water reclamation facilities around central Arizona. We collected samples monthly at the point of compliance where the treatment plant itself would be collecting their water samples. And these water reclamation facilities, really, there was a wide range of treatments. Some of these facilities were not producing irrigation quality water. So when you see the E. coli levels that I'm talking about, don't think that there's something wrong with the treatment plant. There was probably a different target water quality. And I should also mention that some of these treatment plants denitrified the water and others did not. That becomes a little more important later. So what did we find? Well, I'm going to compare this to another study that we did a couple years ago looking at stormwater. Stormwater that was found in the city of Tucson. We were also isolating E. coli from that water. And so during that study, we collected 121 isolates of E. coli. When we confirmed by PCR, we found that about 9% of what we were calling E. coli actually was not by PCR. The false positive rate for the auger that we were using is about 4, according to the manufacturer, so 9 is not so bad. For this study, when we looked at the reclaimed water retention pond and the irrigated soils, our false positive rate went up substantially, and it was quite eye-opening. But municipal wastewater, our false positive rate was nearly 50%. Now, please note that the low number of samples. You're actually looking at data that's still coming off the presses. We can't really make any decisions based on 40 isolates, and we have several hundred left to analyze. So hopefully I'll have something more definitive to report next year. False positives have been reported in the literature, and they have been reported in E. coli assays in particular, and some of the researchers have shown that if you have a high microbial background in the sample, that some of the fighting of microbes do on the auger can lead to the existence of false positives. And there have also been possible links to water salinity and electrical conductivity. So when we analyzed all of our reclaimed water samples, we were doing a whole slew of biological and chemical analyses, and I won't bore you with all of them, but just a couple of the results. If you look at the confirmation results, the first set of numbers are the ones that were confirmed as E. coli, and the second set confirmed as not E. coli in all of our studies. You'll see that the fecal coliforms in the studies where they had a high number, I'm sorry, the fecal coliforms tended to be higher in samples that had false positives of E. coli. The enterococcus tended to be higher. So at first we were thinking that maybe this fact that there were just a lot of other background bacteria in the sample could be true for these samples. However, when you looked at the heterotrophic plate count, it turns out that the heterotrophic plate counts were four times higher when we got good solid results for the E. coli. So the background bacteria did not seem to be the problem. The heterotrophic plate count is statistically significant at this point, so it does look like it's impacting the sample, but in a perhaps an opposite way than reported in the literature. The other two things that we found statistically significant were the alkalinity. So the samples that had essentially less buffering capacity, and even though those numbers are very close together, it was significant. But the samples with less buffering capacity seemed to produce more false positives. And the samples that were not denitrified, we did not find a significant result with nitrate, but we did with nitrite. So it looks like denitrification may be part of the issue. Once again, this is all very hot off the presses, and hopefully we'll have more of an answer in the very near future. Now, so what causes a false positive to occur? Well, when you have E. coli growing on a plate like this, the blue color change to the blue color colony is due to the activity of a glucuronidase enzyme that 95% of known E. coli have. The problem comes in that the glucuronidase enzyme has also recently been identified in all of these other bacterial groups. Now, is this the end of the world? No, not at all, because in fact, in these bacterial groups, you have some very significant disease-causing organisms. So if you're identifying these as well, it's not the worst thing in the world. You certainly would want to know if you had Shigella in a sample. The fact that you're misidentifying it as E. coli, you know, is really a matter of opinion. In fact, we have started to do some sequencing work to figure out what these organisms are that are causing the false positive. And the very first set of sequencing data came back just earlier this week, and we do find that among the isolates that we called E. coli, we do have Citrobacter, Enterobacter, and also Aeromonas. And once again, all three of these can cause disease. So this is not the end of the world. One of the problems with these enzymatic data the biggest problem is that the 0157 group does not contain this enzyme. So if you have essentially what is one of the worst E. coli out there, the one that gets all the press and the one that makes everyone think E. coli is the most evil thing in the world, that will not be identified using these methods. And that, in fact, is a problem. It's a well-known problem. So all of this leads to what is widely known, and that is that we do have a need for improved, simple identification methods. The beauty of these methods, such as ColAlert, which uses the same type of enzyme analysis, is that they're very easy, and that the water reclamation facilities can put their people out there to use them. But the utilization of recycled water is growing nationwide, and particularly in the southwestern United States, where we have severe water shortages looming. there's a thought that if we were better able to identify what was out there, that maybe increased public acceptance will result. Maybe we'll always be battling that yuck factor, as everyone knows. There have been several calls for proposals out. The EPA and as well as the Water Reuse Foundation and several other funding agencies are looking for the development of easy molecular-based assays that only identify viable bacteria. So hopefully sometime in the next couple of years, one of these will in fact be on the market. So I'd just like to acknowledge all of the people that helped and funded this research, and I have to apologize because I'm going to have to run off to my poster. I apologize for the other speakers in the, but I got double booked, so.
Time for a quick question.
Yes, absolutely. But if you want to talk to me, poster 1310. Sorry.
Any quick questions for Gene? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.